I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you guys for showing up here this morning. Couple things. You know, last night we talked a lot about the first step. We talked a lot about a need for applying spiritual principles to our life, you know. And it's really important that as an alcoholic, I understand who I am and why I'm here. Because when the stuff that we're going to talk about today, it's not easy stuff. They're not easy concepts. The spirituality that this book describes is some of the most profound spirituality I have ever encountered. I've read a plethora of spiritual books and tons of writers and a lot of philosophy, and it's amazing to me how much the concepts that are in this book are proliferated in almost all spiritual literature that I have read. You know, because I'm a seeker. I think that part of the broadening and deepening our relationship with God, our spiritual experience, is about seeking truth for ourselves, you know, and trying to be open to what the universe has to offer us, you know. And last night, you know, it's funny because I tend to be shocking when I talk, and there's a reason for it. One thing, because it's funny, and I'm a smartass, but two, because I'll take an absurd concept. And I'll take an absurd concept, and I want it to be something that makes you stop and say, wow. I mean, the typical stuff that we hear in the rooms all the time, you know, the softer, gentler, more commonplace statements, I mean, a lot of times they wash over my head. They have for years now. And then when somebody says something that challenges me, and I say, you know, is that my experience, or do I believe that? You know, sometimes I need to be hit in the head with a 2x4 instead of a feather duster. And one of the things that I do with the people that I sponsor, and especially after a relapse, is I actually read how it works with them. How many times have you guys read, you know, 58 and 59? We read it all the time at meetings. How many times have you really listened to what it says? And it's one of those things that I tend to do with the people I work with, because, I mean, it literally, you know, we say, okay, we state the problem. We have a problem statement. We say that there's a solution, a spiritual experience, right? We say that there's clear-cut directions for that spiritual experience in this book. And then we have a chapter called How It Works. And we start this chapter with spiritual concepts before we even put pen to paper. Because the truth is that what's going to happen now from when we leave aside the drink problem, and we agnostics, it says we leave aside the drink problem and we ask ourselves why we're making a rough going in life, right? My job is not necessarily to look at my relationship with alcohol, but to look at my relationship with the universe from this point on. My relationship with you, my relationship with myself, my relationship with God, my relationship with all that is around me. Because the 12 steps are about relationships. When I mean relationships, I mean that dynamic interaction between myself and other people, things, concepts, you know, principles. So I want to start off and talk a little bit about this, because, I mean, I think Chris and I, as this day goes on, we're going to be talking about some pretty lofty spiritual things. And we're talking about ideals. You know, like anyone else, I mean, this book presents some really lofty spiritual ideas, some beautiful concepts, some beautiful principles. What are the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous? What are the 36, right? The steps, the traditions, and the concepts. Each are extrapolations of one another. The 12 steps are about personal recovery. The traditions are about AA unity. And the concepts are that structure that put it all together and create the atmosphere for the personal recovery. Without any one of those things, it's like a Russian nesting doll. Without any one of those things, it doesn't work. So when we talk about these things and what we're talking about in terms of spiritual life, in terms of spiritual concepts, and we're talking about ideals, there's an understanding that none of us is going to be able to do this perfectly all the time. I am not, you know, a Zen, you know, master by any shape or form. I am a human being, and I fall short all the time. But there are spiritual concepts, principles, ideas that are truths with a capital T for me, that have been presented to me, and when I mean truth with a capital T, I mean an objective truth, that have been presented to me through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, concepts that I base my life and my worldview on. everything that I experience, everything that I do, everything that I believe is based on these fixed points. And what I experience in my life kind of revolves around these fixed points or concepts. So we'll start off with reading how it works and taking it into consideration for a minute. Do you guys know what the consideration method is? The consideration method, if you don't, is when you take ideas or concepts, you know, big book, other spiritual literature, and you sit with it and you ask yourself, what does this mean to me? Now, as an alcoholic, I'm a people pleaser. And I also don't ever like to look bad. Never like to look bad. So I have to know the answer for everything. And I had this sponsor who used to say to me, you would give me spiritual direction, and I would be like, I know. And he would say, will you stop saying you know? Because if you knew, you wouldn't be asking me this asinine question. Instead, say okay. Because the ego wants to say, I know. No, I don't fucking know. Because if I knew, I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have broken my toy and then showed up to my sponsor and said, please fix this because I broke it. So for me, rather than saying, I know, I say, okay, or is this true? First question is this true? And then if it's true, then okay. So let's sit with this really quick. And of course, I hate reading aloud. Mind you, I'm dyslexic, so I'm going to do the best that I can. But we're on page 58. And it says how it works. How does this program work? How does the spiritual principles, the application of this, the recovery from the alcoholic affliction work? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. When I've fallen short, when I relapsed, when I failed, have I really thoroughly followed the path? Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Have I? Big consideration. Have I given myself to this simple program? Usually men and women are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Have I truly been honest with myself? Or have I been fooling myself about the values of certain behaviors, concepts, or ideas? There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Does my manner of living demand rigorous honesty? Or do I white lie? Do I project something onto the world? Do I project a persona onto the world that I think people want to see so that I can have people like me, so I can have acceptance, so I can have approval, so that my ego can be validated deep down inside knowing that I am not what I'm presenting to the outside world? Do I do that? Do I lie by omission? By what I do? Or am I vulnerable, honest, and humble? Not all the time, by the way. Right? Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And that's the thing. Do I have that capacity to be honest, or do I write myself a check and say, well, you know, I probably exhibit that behavior because of, you know, past trauma, PTSD, and blah, 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 blah. I had a woman I sponsored for a long time, and whenever I would sit and talk to her, and she would like, well, I do that because of PTSD. And I said, well, where does your PTSD end and your alcoholism begin? She got really quiet. I was like, well, how do you know that's not your alcoholism? You're putting a label on something. You're saying, I exhibit this behavior because of this. Can you consider that you exhibit that behavior because you're human and that spiritual principles applied to any human problem probably could fix it? She was like, whoa. Because we categorize things in our head. You guys ever hear something called the categorical imperative? Anybody here read Kant? Okay. I'm a dork. I'm sorry. But basically what it says is that human beings have a mind that works in a way that needs to put things in categories. That when we process information, what we do is we assimilate information and relate it to things that we already know. Right? So for me, when I experience something, I'm going to take that experience and I'm going to process it, and I'm going to say, well, that's related to this, and this is related to that. And I'm essentially going to compartmentalize my experience. And when I do that, what I'm doing is I'm having a fractured experience because I'm taking that experience and I'm breaking it up into pieces and I'm putting labels on it. And by doing that, I'm sort of playing God, not sort of, I am, but I'm also limiting my experience because I'm saying, well, this experience is related to this label, and this experience is related to that label. You know, am I a mother? Am I a wife? Am I a daughter? Am I a sister? Am I an employee? Am I a supervisor? Am I a student? Am I a sponsor? Am I a sponsee? Am I a friend? I'm all of those things. So why do they have to be independent of one another? Do I have to have a persona for each one of those relationships that I have, or is there a carry that is a whole? So when we think about it, when I exhibit a behavior, when I'm doing something, am I putting a label on it and associating, say, well, that's never going to get fixed? Or am I open to the idea that all things can be improved by the application of spiritual principles? Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. So when I go to an AA meeting and I'm sharing, am I telling 30 minutes of war story and 5 minutes of recovery? No. I tell what it was like so that the newcomer can identify. That's what we did last night. I tell about what happened. I worked at 12 steps. What's it like now? I live on a spiritual basis, but what does that look like? Because it's a wonderful thing to say, I live on a spiritual basis. Great. What's that look like? For each one of us, it's different. But it's one of those things, talking about that transactional relationship that we have with our Creator, because that dynamic, that thing, is kind of like talking about what goes on in your bedroom. It's very private, isn't it? And it's very hard to put words to and explain. So a lot of times, for me, I avoid it because it's almost like I don't know how to describe. How do you describe that relationship? It's almost, words almost trivialize it. But on some level, I need to represent or explain what living on a spiritual basis looks like, because for me, I would know what a spiritual principle was. I would know what I had to do, but I wouldn't know how to actually apply it. It's like the concept between the difference between basic and applied. You know, we do research for terms just for research sake, and then we do research in terms of applied research in real life situations. So when we talk about spiritual concepts, we're talking about it in terms of the philosophy. But we also want to be able to talk about what does that philosophical concept look like and how does that translate into real life action? And the truth is that sometimes it almost doesn't look any different than not living on a spiritual basis, except for what goes on within us. That somebody who's living on a spiritual basis and somebody who's not may almost appear to outward appearances, go to work, shop, take care of the kids, you know, go bowling, do all of those things. But there's that sense that's within us that's also hard to describe when you have it. That we would like to present to the world, because that's the kind of unknowable variable that can be very frightening for a newcomer when we tell them, well, you know, you have to change everything about your life. You just gave up the very thing that was helping you, like, you know, not kill yourself and others and live on a spiritual basis. Good luck with that, kid. So part of it is talking about what that looks like, and even if you lack the language or that the concepts feel difficult because it's a very intimate thing. Is this making sense to you? So it says, at some of these, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go at any length to get it, you're ready to take certain steps. So here's a question. Do we want what they have? Do I want what the first 100 have? Am I willing to go to any lengths to get it? Chris was talking about having that conversation with the newcomer, sitting down, breaking down the first step and explaining the deadly nature of the disease and having them look at you blankly when you're like, well, so do you want to work some steps? I had that conversation last week, and literally a woman was less than 24 hours abstinent from alcohol, broke down the first step, called in the troops. We had a round table first step intervention type, you know, experience with this woman, broke down the first step in great detail, and then she looked at me and she said, well, I'll probably call somebody next week and start working on that. I said, well, you know, you just got shot. Your gut shot. You walked into the emergency room, and I'm totally robbing this from somebody, but it's a great analogy. You got a gut shot, walked into the emergency room and said, well, you know, I'm going to wait till I almost bleed to death before I go to surgery. I'm going to sit right here in the corner. Wake me up when I'm almost dead and fix me. You know, and she just kind of looked at me blankly, and I said, you haven't had it yet. You haven't had the experience of what it means to be hopeless. That experience that Bill talked about in his story when he talks about the quicksand and the bitter morass of self-pity, right? Alcohol was his master. If you haven't experienced that, if you haven't experienced that in the deep inner recesses of you, you're not going to have that willingness to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism. I had a sponsor. He lived an hour from me. If I showed up 5 minutes late for a step appointment, he would tell me to go home. And the first two times that happened, I got really pissed. I'm like, "Dad," I was like, "I have three kids. I live an hour away. There's freaking traffic. What's wrong with you?" And he said something very simply to me. He said, "Well, why won't you make this important?" I'm like, "Well, I make it important. I drive an hour down here. It takes 4 hours of my time." He's like, "But it's not important enough to leave 5 minutes early when you know there's traffic. What were you doing in that 5 minutes before you left? Combing my hair, checking my makeup. So that's more important than, not dying an alcoholic death? Good point. I was never late again." Now, it was this very simple thing, but it taught me a lesson. It made me ask myself, is my hair or, those two dishes that were in the sink that I absolutely had to do before I left the house more important than recovering from alcoholism? So the question is, am I willing to go to any lengths? Am I ready to take certain steps? And some of these we balked. Of course, they suck. They're scary. Who wants to knock on the door of somebody you totally screwed over, pay back the money, and admit to things that you didn't get caught for? No sane person wants to do that, except for somebody who's dying an alcoholic death and wants to stop that process. We thought we can find an easier, softer way, but we could not. That's a question. And here's another question. Are we trying to find an easier, softer way in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? How many of us have made 89% or 98% of our amends and left those last two that were just icky and didn't want to do it? Did mostly. Not all. I did until I got yelled at. Actually, what happened is I did until my sponsor told me I was not allowed to share in a meeting until I made every single amends on my list. And I'll tell you what, when you don't get to share in a meeting and somebody's talking about like dark tunnel stuff and you want to scream and hit them with a big book and whatever, and you're sitting there and you can't say nothing because you didn't make your amends, makes you make your amends. But there was one of those things, that question is, even knowing that this is the solution to my problem, do I sometimes take an easier, softer way? Do I skimp? Do I do inventory in my head and think my way through it and then hope that maybe I figure out the solution to that? Because that works really well. So it says, "With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start." Am I fearless and thorough? Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas. The result was nil until we let go absolutely. So when we talked about last night, we said that our ideas didn't work and the God idea did. See, again, Big Book Nooms, man. We've been reading this every day in every damn meeting that we have been to for the past, I don't know how many years. And then all of a sudden, there's this sentence that says that I have to let go of all my old ideas. Not the ones that are inconvenient, not the ones that are annoying, not the ones that aren't working, but everything. Let go absolutely. I don't get to decide what my brain says. I don't get to decide what my I don't get to dictate my own reality. Because the truth is that my life, my recovery, my spirit, it's none of my business. I am not in the outcome business anymore. I don't get to decide what Carrie's recovery looks like. Because, my recovery is, smoking some bones, chilling out, having a beer, putting my feet up and thinking about God a little bit. That's Carrie's plan of recovery. So my best thinking sucks donkey balls. So my job is to put aside everything I think I know, let go of my old ideas, and be open to new ones. Let go absolutely. Am I willing to do that? Remember that we deal with alcohol. Oh, so Bill's so smart. He says, "Look, you got to give up all this stuff, rigorously honest, commit yourself to this way of life, blah, blah, blah. Stop making excuses for yourself, because even if you're totally batshit, you could still get sober if you're honest. And by the way, if you don't, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful and will kick your ass. Good luck with that. Which is easier, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis? Cost-benefit analysis. And it says, but there one, but this is the most beautiful statement in this book. It says, but there is one who is all power. That one is God. May you find him now. One. It's a statement. Do I believe that? Is there a God who has all power and that I can find him now? And that's a direction. Find him now. That's the other beautiful thing. That's a consideration. Do I believe that that's true? Is it possible? And then it's a direction. It's a directive. It's telling me, go find this God now, 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 now. Not yesterday, not next week, not when I feel like it, not when my TV show is over, not when Survivor's over or when Big Brother's done. Now! The time frame of the Big Book is always about the present moment. It doesn't give a crap about next week, and it doesn't give a crap about last year. It's about now. So the work I did last year has absolutely nothing to do with the work that I'm doing today. Because what I did last year earned me that 24 hours last year. What is going to earn me the 24 hours for today? Applying those principles today. Half measures availed us nothing. Is that my experience? When I half-ass this stuff, what happens? I screw it up. My sponsor used to tell me all the time that my spirit, my ego writes a check my spirit can't cash. It says, we stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Now, we've been reading this every day in meetings for years. But have we ever really sat and thought about all of this prepares us for our fourth step, our fifth step, our sixth step, our seventh step, our eighth step, our ninth step? All of this, this statement right here, how it works, tells us you will not fail. Rarely will you fail if you thoroughly follow our path. It is time to commit. It is time to get going. It's time to start moving now. So we talked a little bit about step three. And Chris went through the actor, and he talked about selfishness and self-centeredness as being the root of our troubles, right? He says that we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate seemingly without provocation, but at some time in the past, we made a decision based on self that placed us in a position to be hurt. Yeah, my sponsor made me read 60 to 64 every day, because for me, I forget that I'm being the actor when I think I'm being virtuous. I forget that because I'm being nice, I want something out of you. I'm not being nice for nice sake. I'm not being unselfish for unselfishness sake. I'm often doing those things because I expect a specific result, a certain reaction. If I don't get it, I'm annoyed. And I think, well, I'm playing the game. I'm doing unselfish things on the outside. My actions look unselfish, but my motivation in the inside is about getting for me, whether it's recognition, approval, acceptance, you know. And when I don't do that, when people don't agree with me, then I'm hurt, threatened, or interfered with. So my sponsor had me read 60 to 63, the actor in the eye, every day and ask myself, am I doing those things in my life? It's a great exercise. You know, you don't have to do it every day for like a year, but try it. Try it. Just try sitting in the morning, before you do your morning meditation or after you do your morning meditation, read these paragraphs in the eye. You know, the first requirement is that I be convinced that life on self-will is hardly a success. I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. You know, if only everybody would do as I wish. And I read it in the eye, and I'm telling you, it wakes me up to the things, the motivations or the behaviors that I cloak in spiritual make-believe. You ever hear that term, spiritual make-believe? Where we do things and we say that we're doing it for a spiritual or unselfish reason. In reality, we're doing it to serve ourselves. How many people have tried to save another alcoholic through sponsorship, and in reality, your ego was engaged in that battle and not your spirit? I'll save her. Nobody else has sobered her up. But the 17th time she went through the steps, because I have this very special way of doing it, and I'm the most effective sponsor ever, I will drag her out of the gates of death, right? Like, I'm freaking God, and I got the magic answer. I got the magic bone, and I'll hand it to her, and all of a sudden she'll stop drinking, right? Because it has nothing to do with me. Sponsorship has nothing to do with me and everything to do with God. My job is to be his tool, literally. That's it. I transmit information. God does the rest of it. When my ego engages in that, and I'm saving people, and I'm fixing people, and I'm here sounding good here, and I'm here doing that, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, you know, I might think that I'm doing the right thing, but 9 times out of 10, I'm really serving my ego to make myself feel important or special. My sponsor used to tell me all the time, he said, like, he's like, only alcoholics will try to be somebody in a program full of nobodies. We're like the most reviled human beings on the face of the earth, right? You know, you have like pedophiles and like child killers, and then you have like drug addicts and alcoholics, right? Like, we're not the, you know, top run of society, right? And we're a whole program full of people who are just fucked up. And we come here and I'm like, I'm going to run this joint. I'm going to be the king of the, you know, land of the broken fucking toys. I'm the king booby, like Chris was talking about. I mean, like, seriously, my home group just ain't doing it right. Bleeding deacon, you know? So there, yeah, exactly. So like, there's that thing. It's like only an alcoholic will want to rule all the other social rejects. And of course, I know the right way to govern all of you people. So there's that idea, and these are things that when I'm reading these pages, when I'm taking these concepts, when I'm looking at them, I want to take them and say, you know, where am I doing that? Do I do that with my kids? And I'll kind of wrap it up with this because I know Chris wants to talk a little bit. I have an 18-year-old daughter. I was actually telling this story this morning. I have an 18-year-old daughter. So last week I came home. Oh, no, I didn't come home. I'm sorry. Well, last week I was leaving for work, and, like, she sleeps in because she's 18. She just graduated from high school. So I knock on her door. And I open it, and there's her boyfriend in her bed. Yeah. So mom does what mom does. So mom, like, do you ever see, like, Psycho Mom? Like, I had a Linda Blair. My head spun around. Pea soup went everywhere. I said something along the lines, if you get fucking pregnant, I'm not raising your fucking child. Something along those lines. You know, had a total conniption, right? So then I stomp out of the house. No pause, no God, no nothing, just bah! So I call somebody up and I'm like, so how odd was that reaction? He's like, not at all. So she didn't come home for 24 hours, so she decided that she was going to punish me by disappearing for a day and wouldn't answer her phone. So 4 o'clock in the morning, I finally get a hold of her. I actually get her on Facebook. Like, you know, like, she won't answer my texts and my phone calls, but she answers my Facebook message. I love that. You know, because she, you know, and so I'm having this conversation with her. And all of a sudden, this really rational person started coming out. And I'm having this conversation. I said, okay, you're an adult. All right, let's think about this. Let's think about the decisions you're making in your life. Let's think about, well, what are the possible consequences? What is it that you want out of life? What is this? What is that? You want to be independent. What does that look like to you? And all of a sudden, I start having this conversation about ideals and what that looks like and who do you want to be with my 18-year-old daughter, who just less than 24 hours ago, I walked in on her in a very compromising position with her boyfriend at 8 in the morning before I had to go to work. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, you know, this is not me at all. I have nothing to do with this conversation. Nothing. This is all God having this conversation for me because I'm too tired because it's 4 in the morning and I've been up all night waiting for my daughter. You know, and she came home and my husband, her boyfriend and I sat down and her had a nice conversation and it's never going to happen again. But the point was, is that sometimes that reaction that I had, it was like a reaction. But they're not always bad, too. And that's one of the beautiful things that I saw. It was like sometimes when you have that experience, even though, you know, you might be pulling your hair out and you may not be looking all that serene and all, you might look like a crazy person like I did, it scared the crap out of my daughter and it made her reconsider the decision she's making in her life. And then we got to have a rational conversation about it. And I made amends for losing my temper. And she looked at me and she was like, Mom, I'm surprised you didn't beat the crap out of me. And I was like, well, I don't hit my kids. You know, but you know, when she saw, like, my God, my nice mom just completely lost her mind at 8 o'clock in the morning. What happened here? But this is what we're talking about. this is what we're talking about, these things, living on this basis, making these decisions and doing these things and not always being perfect, but trying the best that we can to live up to these spiritual principles. You know, I do not own myself nor my spirit. I am God's child. He is my director. He is my father. And it is my duty to do his job, to do what he wants me to do. I made a deal with him in the third step prayer. What I said is, I'm fucked up and broken. I cannot fix myself. I'm offering myself to you to fix me, to build with me, to do with me as you will. Meld me, put me back together in the way that you see fit so that I can be a vision of what your grace is on this earth. Don't fix me for my comfort. Fix me so that I can serve you. My life has been about my comfort my entire life. It's always been about me feeling better. We lie to feel better. We rationalize to feel better. We tell ourselves stories about our behaviors to feel better. You know, I put on makeup so I could be pretty, so that people can like me, so I can feel better. We do things all the time for comfort. Comfort is not always what we need. For me, it's about challenging and learning to be uncomfortable and happy at the same time. So when I ask God to relieve me of my difficulties, when I ask him to relieve me of the bondage to self, when I ask him to take those things away, I'm not asking him to do those things so I can feel better. I'm asking him to do those things so I can serve him, because serving myself has sucked up until this point. And I have failed utterly at it. You want
to? Sure. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. You know, Carrie got me thinking this morning about the challenge of children. my wife and I have 3 children and 5 grandchildren, and you know, the grandchildren are not a problem yet. We're like in the midst of spoiling them, and you know, figuring out how to do that adequately. But the children have been 2 out of 3 of the children have been a challenge. You know, my daughter has a long way to go, I think, to learn to take, you know, to make the right decisions, to make decisions that are, you know, pointing her in the right direction. And she's doing much better this year than she has in the past. My wife's son was another challenge. He comes over to our house about 4 months ago, nodding out and admitting that he's been on heroin for 6 years, and he wants some help. And you know, you want to see a mother get concerned. You know what I mean? That happened very, very quickly. You know, luckily enough, I had some experience in this area, and I had some resources that I could, I could enlist. And I'd like to say now that, you know, he's not only doing well, he's doing really, really well. And I'm grateful for that. You know, a lot of times we want to have control over something like that. We want to say, okay, here's a problem and damn it, I'm going to fix it, when it has to do with somebody else and their addictive illness. And you know, it's more to do with their relationship with God and where they are with, you know, their ability to perceive reality than it has to do with us trying to shove it in a certain direction. I work with a lot of families, and so often families come to me after trying to put their children, you know, putting their children into rehab for like 20 times. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, I can see the frustration. I can see their frustration. And, you know, you just don't hear until you can hear. And you just don't see until you can see. And a lot of times it's very, very difficult for us to be able to accept that when it's our kids. You know, it's okay when it's your kid, but, you know, it's my kid. I'm going to make this work. I think the best news is we have experience with recovery. If you're in this room, you're probably part of the choir that we're preaching to. And that means that you've got some really good connections, some really good information, and some really good experience. So it's That's very, very helpful. To be able to point somebody in the right direction when they're ready is very, very, very helpful. I want to talk about something just before we get going on the fourth step here. And it's something that I learned in business. You know, Bill Wilson used business analogies all the time. We're going to take an inventory, and let's look at the business inventory. He thought that way, and I think that's a good way to think. What I've been doing for the last 20 years or so is I've been a facility manager, and through basically no fault of my own, I've been promoted up, basically because I'm not shooting myself in the foot every couple of months like I did when I was drinking, but today I'm a facility manager for a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant. I've got like 100 employees and, you know, all these contractors and literally $14 million budget. I mean, it's crazy that's me. You wouldn't have wanted me running your lemonade stand, you know, in the 80s, let alone giving me like $14 million to spend. I'm serious, but I do a fairly good job. But anyway, in this picture a pharmaceutical manufacturing business. This is where they make the tablets for the life-saving medications. Now, they have two things that are very, very important in those processes. They have best practices, which is basically you learn the absolute best way through experience and experimentation. You learn the best way to do something. And then they have what's known as a change control procedure, which is absolutely vital for this specific function. So they've learned the absolute best way to do something, and then they lock you into a change control procedure. And how that would work, well, I'll talk about a mistake that was made recently. There's an assembly line, and it's got all these parts, and one of the parts broke. And they found out that it would probably take 2 or 3 weeks to get this part. So somebody went into a machine shop and made the part. They didn't think that that was really any problem, you know, but it wasn't an exact fit. So what that did was when the validation experts noticed that there was a change in the assembly line, they put all the medication on hold until they could validate whether that change had an impact to the pharmaceutical product. So what they do is they are very, very specific about the details of these procedures. They don't want you to go any to the left or to the right. They want you to be following them specifically. Now, when they put together the recovery process in this book, and when it's mentioned that rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path, you know, we should be looking at this process with the same vision that you would look at with a change control procedure. We do not want to change anything that's in here. We don't want to be the ones to decide, well, I know it says to do this, but I'm going to do this because I don't really see a problem with it. If you did that in the pharmaceutical manufacturing plant, you would lose your job in half a second.
Yep.
It's that important. So when we're looking at the instructions in this book, as we start to go through how it works and into action, think about exactly what it's asking us to do. Mm-hmm. And then we all need to ask ourselves the question, is this how I've done it? Is this my experience? Did I do it this way? Do I have experience with this? Because if you don't, you can't be part of the rarely club. To be part of the rarely club, you have to have thoroughly followed these processes. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to do some of this stuff. Some of this stuff is a revolutionary change for us. You know, listen, we don't want it to be our fault. If it's our fault, that's inconvenient. You know, we always want the fault to lie outside of ourselves. But where this inventory process is going to take us is it's going to take us to the realization that our problems are not coming at us, they're coming from us. And when you get to that shift in perception, when you realize that your problems are of your own making, that is a shift in perception that has a lot to do with becoming recovered. Because if you can see that you're creating your own problems, then there's hope in that. There's hope in that, because with a different set of behavioral characteristics and spiritual practices, you can maybe stop shooting yourself in the foot and stop causing yourself all of these problems. I couldn't leave the house in the 80s without, you know, getting arrested or getting into a fight with a neighbor or the car breaking down or, you know, some travesty. I mean, I was drama, you know, in the 80s. That's what I was. And if you would have asked me, you know, Chris, why are you so stupid? I would have said, I'm not stupid. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm Mensa, you know, IQ. Yeah, but you're an idiot. You know, you don't know how to get out of bed the right way. You know, I swear to God. I remember this one time, you know, I woke up in the middle of the night. You know, I'd been drinking, you know, as was my wont. And I woke up in the middle of the night, you know how you have to get to the bathroom at like 3 in the morning and, you know, the lights are out. And I tripped on some clothes that I threw down on the floor. And as I tripped and as I went down, I didn't realize it, but my door was open. So my head hit the edge of the big old wooden door and split my head open. And I come up like this and there's blood in my eyes and I can't see. And, you know, I was only 30 years old at the time, so I was still living with my mother. So, you know, that's what macho guys do, you know. And so I go downstairs and I'm going like, oh, like this. And I'm trying to find the sink to wash the blood out of my eyes. And my mother comes out of her room and she's like, ah, like this, you know. I'm like, ah, I mean, I couldn't even go to the bathroom without splitting my head open. I was a walking travesty. You know, but when you tell me that my problems are of my own making, you know, I'm insulted, you know. What do you mean by that? This is all bad breaks, misunderstandings, and, you know, the other guy. But the fact of the matter is if it's bad breaks, if it's misunderstandings, and it's the other guy, do you ever have any hope of it getting better? Do you have any control over that other stuff? Really, the only thing that you can possibly control is taking some of these exercises. And what these exercises will do is slowly you'll start to live, slowly or quickly, depending how you address these things, you'll start to live a more spiritual life, and you'll be able to stay out of your own way. You know, have you ever seen, well, there's two types of old timers. There's the cranky, unrecovered old timer that we all know so well. You know, he's like, I've been sober 20 years. I never did any steps. I think all those steps, I was a crap. If when I first came in, they told me I had to do all these steps, I'd have been out of here. And you know, whenever I hear that, I think, Clem, you're overly concerned with what we would think about you being here. You know, we would probably be fine with you not being here, Clem. And I hate to break that to you. You know, and someday you'll get recovered, and it'll show on your face if we're all lucky. And then there's another type of old-timer who's experienced some of this recovery stuff, and they are at peace. They are so at peace. You know, they'll come in and they'll share that, you know, that their wife died after, and they've been married for 45 years. And they'll be like, okay. And you're like, how in the world are you okay with something like that? And it's because they've come to the realization of their true purpose in this universe, you know, and a true understanding of what is meaningful and what's going to happen, and that they're a spiritual person having a human experience, and all is well, you know. That's what you learn after practicing these spiritual principles so many years, that all is well. We need to learn how to do this stuff, though. We can't stumble our way into spiritual living. We're not capable of it because we've built our whole perspective on the foundation of selfishness and self-centeredness. We personally aren't capable of finding our own spirituality without some help, mm-hmm. without some guidance, without some direction. It's not possible. You know, we're going to be fooling ourselves if we think we're getting spiritual because we're reading The Road Less Traveled or something, you know? I just read The Road Less Traveled, man. That's so cool. It's a great book, okay? What I'm talking about is reading it and thinking you've advanced spiritually. You know, it doesn't happen intellectually. It has to happen experientially. It has to happen because of behavioral change. You know, we want so much for recovery to be, you know, an intellectual experience, but it's just not. We have to behave our way spiritual. And to do that, we need some help because we're just not capable of it. Now, one of the amazing things was Bill Wilson and the cats who started putting this thing together, and the inventory process. When I first was exposed to this inventory process, I thought it was a little silly. You know, resentments, fear. I'm not afraid of anything. Sex conduct. I haven't had a relationship in 7 years because, you know, I was such an idiot and I was blackout drunk at 7 o'clock every night. That cuts down on your dating. So, you know, vomiting and hollering just wasn't doing it for, you know, the women in my life. So looking at some of this stuff, if you're alcoholic, you're always going to think this doesn't quite apply to you because your case is just a little bit different than the rest of the mutton heads in this room. You know what I mean? Like I know everything. I know I look like the rest of these, but there's something going on inside me that's different, you know? And if you've ever thought that, welcome, you're in the right room. That's a requirement for membership, thinking you're different. But the fact of the matter is I've got a lot of experience with this inventory process. I've got a lot of experience taking people through this inventory process. It so works. The fourth step is about resentment, fear, and conduct. And those three things are the whole megillah as far as what's blocking us off from an experience with the divine that will allow us a recovery experience. Now, in the book, it starts off with resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And, you know, rather than share specifically on the specific instructions in this, I want to talk more generally about why this was important for me. Resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. Well, what about alcohol? You think they really meant it kills more people than alcohol? Kills more people than suicide? Because alcoholics are something like 60 times more likely to take their own life than a non-alcoholic. So there's a lot of things that kill us. Could resentment really be the number one thing? And I've had to really think about this. You know, after doing a bunch of resentment inventory, it was amazing I could even get to AA with all of my resentments. Now, I talked a little bit last night about what would go on in my head sitting in a meeting. You know, I hated 99 people out of 100. I could not stand. And the maniac, the insane maniac is the one that I would be drawn toward. You know, that would be my friend. You know, the insane lunatic. And so, but think about this. This is my experience in my first year. I so needed AA. I so needed AA. I was fast on the way to drinking myself to death, you know, on all four burners. Now, I knew that my only hope could possibly be Alcoholics Anonymous. So I struggled my way back in between Christmas and New Year's 1989. I struggled my way back in to AA. just absolutely desperate. I was not at all sure it would work. As a matter of fact, I thought that it might not. It probably wouldn't, because I had experience with AA before, but I didn't have any other plans. I was out of plans, and I did not want to die. So I go, okay, I'm going to try this, and I'm going to really put some time into it. And that's basically what I did. But here's my experience. My first home group is Morristown, New Jersey. And it's really clicky. And nobody's saying hi to me. And, you know, they're kind of ignoring me, and it just doesn't seem like I fit in. These people are a bunch of jerks. I don't like this home group. I'm getting out of here. Now think about that. The thing that I needed for survival was Alcoholics Anonymous, and my resentments pushed me out of that group. The only thing I did right is I went to another home group. So my next home group was Myersville, New Jersey, the closed-minded Tuesday night discussion meeting. And so I start going to Myersville. Now, Myersville's a big meeting, a lot of young people. I made a lot of friends. This is like the middle of 1990. I made a lot of friends, and it was kind of a cool group. There was very little recovery going on, but, man, we had some serious fellowship. You know, we were fellowshipping, you know what I mean? We'd go out to the dances, and, you know, we'd have the sober softball and all that crap. And I was starting to learn how to have kind of a good time. But what happened was there were some slow, painful, root canal-esque business meetings. Anybody ever been in those? You know what I mean? Yeah. Oh, those are really good to have, you know, if you got a home group. Those business meetings, have one every week. Good God. Well, there'd always be somebody like, I want a treasurer's report, you know, and I want to know where our $4.50 are going, you know what I mean? And then somebody'd be like, well, we've never given a treasurer report here, and we're not going to change now. And so the whole group is like, they want to kill each other, you know, over like $4.50. So I'm like, I'm out of here, you know, I'm out of here. I'm feeling uncomfortable. I'm pissed off at the idiots that want a treasurer report. You know, I want to share. I don't want to hear a treasurer report. So I'm out of there. I'm out of there. There's a resentment, and I'm gone, okay? Think about it. I'm an alcoholic if I don't stay close to, if I'm not rubbing up on all of you. I'm forgetting I'm an alcoholic, and I'm forgetting to do the things that I need to do. That's a really bad place for me. The one thing I did right is I got another home group. Now, by this time, I had started to do some steps. So after getting through the steps, I could get through the resentment and stay in the home group even when it's filled with buttonheads. I don't have to go anywhere. You know what I mean? I can stay safe in the nest. You know what I mean? So can resentments kill you? Absolutely, they can. You know how many people come into AA and leave? And it's almost always because of a resentment. Oh, those people. Have you ever talked to somebody, oh, yeah, I tried AA. All they do is sit around and bitch. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. You know, that's somebody who resented their way right back out, and they're usually still drinking or dysfunctional or on wheelbarrow loads of psych meds. You know what I mean? It's bad. Fear. I want to talk about fear. If you would have come up to me on day one and you would have said, Chris, you know, fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of your existence is shot through with it. It's causing all kinds of problems in your life. I would have said, what are you talking about? Because I was incredibly daring. I raced motorcycles. We used to go bridge and cliff diving. I would pick on the biggest guy at the bar, you know, if I wanted to get into a fight. I was crazy. I was nuts. And how can I possibly be riddled with fear if I'm this daring? Because I was crazy. So I didn't get it. I didn't know what you were talking about. The type of fear that they're talking about, the evil and corroding thread, is a self-centered fear. It presents as anxiety. It presents as being uncomfortable with yourself and your environment and just not wanting to be here with these people right now, wanting to be somewhere else. And this was all over me when I first showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this fear was the thing that would tell me when it was 15 minutes until the meeting that I don't really need to go tonight. I don't want to walk down into that basement. You know, that's the fear. And that fear could have killed me 100 different ways. Just not feeling comfortable, because I was not comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning. I was not comfortable sharing. I was not comfortable being honest with my sponsor. And all of this had to do with my anxiety and my fear about people finding out. Now, what does the fourth step have to do with this fear? My first four step was all the dirty little secrets I ever had. I didn't know how to write inventory when I first did it. I basically did a life story with all the garbage. And I hid that thing underneath the spare tire in the back of my car trunk in case somebody would find it. Because if somebody would have found that, I would have had to move out of the country. That's how I felt, right? I share it with my sponsor. And at the end, he goes, "Okay, Chris, all right, that's not so bad. That's not so bad. That was the whole Megilla. That was everything that I was totally ashamed and humiliated. It had it all in there, right?" And he's like, "That's not so bad." I walked away from there thinking, you know what? He's right. That isn't so bad. You know, and I'm taking action today to try to learn how to be a better person, you know? And I started to feel like, you know, I was not such a scumbag at that particular moment. Now, today, if I had that inventory that I was so ashamed of sitting right here, I'd read it to you right now if it wasn't in poor taste. It would probably be in poor taste to do so. But it doesn't have any power over me anymore, you know?
I want to hear it.
Carrie wants to hear it. But you understand what I'm saying? So this inventory process pulls us into freedom from that kind of fear, the kind of fear that can kill us. Another thing in this inventory is conduct, emphasis on sex. Oh, my God. You know, it says we alcoholics need an overhauling there when it's talking about our sex conduct. No kidding. You know what I mean? Here was my method of operation. I would find somebody that was attracted to me by accident somehow, you know, and swoop in and, you know, and take hostage this person and then basically let them know all of my requirements and how they're going to have to learn how to read my mind and, you know, and do this and do that. And usually they're standing there looking at me like, "What?" You know, nobody was going to play by that rule book. So everything always blew up like the Hindenburg. It was just crazy. It was crazy the perception and perspective I had on intimate relationships. It was bizarre. And some of the things that I did in those relationships, because alcoholics are sensitive, we have sensitive alcoholic feelings. You know, when we do something wrong, it hurts us. I mean, guilt, shame, remorse. We're not psychopaths who can hurt somebody and never think about it again. You know, what happens with us is we cause harm and it haunts us in different ways. Well, in the intimate relationships, I really cared about some of these people that I hurt. You know, I loved some of them and I cared for some of them. And I did some horrific stuff, because if you drink a quart of alcohol every night for 10 years and you're involved in relationships with somebody, there's going to be some things that are going to go south. You know what I mean? And there was, you know, my family left me, and, you know, I had a series of terrible relationships. And whenever I would think back to these women, and sometimes even to really good friends, because I believe this particular inventory is an intimacy inventory more than it is a sex inventory. It has to do with people that we're really close to. When I would think back about these relationships, I would be stabbed with guilt and remorse over, you know, over my behavior and or their behavior or whatever. And I would just stew in this thinking back about, you know, how I lost, you know, something incredibly valuable. And that type of pain, really, really gets you in a place where you need to escape from it. And so if we don't inventory our behavior and our conduct with these relationships, we're going to continue to feel the guilt, the shame, and the remorse, and that's going to drive us into the unmanageability that drives us into alcohol. I had to learn relationship skills. It's a great line in the 12 and 12. It says, defective relationships are almost always the cause of our immediate woes, including our alcoholism. You know, so relationships are something that we should pay special attention to. You know, our behavior and our conduct in these relationships. So the inventory gets us to answer a whole number of questions about a relationship. You know, and we need to come to terms with the mistakes that we've been making. And then we need to put together a plan for moving into the future with our conduct and how it relates to other people. We need a sex ideal or a relationship ideal, and we need to work toward it, and we need to ask God to help mold and direct us into this ideal so that we can become the type of people who are causing much, much less harm and have the characteristics and the attributes that we really want to have and have those characteristics accessible. So, you know, without getting into the specific details of the four-step, that's really how I feel about why the four-step is important. And I'll say this, and then I'll turn it back over to Carrie. If you've never done a four-step like this, you don't even know what the problem is in your life. You're stumbling around asleep thinking you're awake. This particular inventory will show you the mistakes that are being made. This inventory will show you what's going wrong and what is blocking you off from God, your fellow man, and a true understanding of your purpose in life, why you are here. This inventory will help unblock you from the things that are causing your failure at life. And it is incredibly important. Please don't buy Uncle Wally's step guide and go through that, okay? Or Happy Hill's step. Use the book Alcoholics Anonymous, because rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed this path, not Happy Hill's path. You know what I mean? Please stick to the big book. After that, the spiritual life is broad, roomy, all-inclusive. Get every step guide in the world and do it. You know, fine. But this is the best practice. This is the change control that you need to pay attention to and you need to not deviate from. Or else the compliance officers are going to come after you. And what that means is you can be drinking with those compliance officers pretty quickly.
So I want to talk a little bit more in detail, not in terms of directions, but in terms of concepts when it comes to the fourth step and the fifth step. And the reason why I do this is because, you know, I've been privileged. I mean, I said, I'm like probably the luckiest girl in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the big book that I grew up in was with the heavy hitters, and I was their mascot. So, like, you know, I've been doing inventory and, you know, looking at these spiritual principles and looking at these concepts since I was like 23 years old. So like now after, you know, I'm 37 now, so it's been 14 years. So like they've become natural breathing, living parts of my being. But I'll tell you what, I don't know how many times I've gotten women who have like, you know, 10, 11 years sober, you know, stark raving crazy, you know, cheating on their husband, you know, starving themselves into, you know, Auschwitz, you know, physique, you know, spending themselves into debt, doing all these things. And I'm talking to them, and I'm like, well, have you written inventory? Yeah, I've written inventory. You know, I've done a four-step. Really? You've done a fifth-step? Yep. You know, four columns? Yeah. So then I start working with them. I was like, okay, well, maybe we need to go through the steps again. Because that's the thing is, like, you know, the first time you go through the steps, it is a lot about the wreckage and the drinking. And the successive times, I mean, I've gone through the steps just about once a year for the past, like, 16 years. You know, I've gone 18 months, but roughly I've gone through the steps Well, actually, there was a time when I went through like 4 or 5 times in 1 year because I was really crazy. So, I mean, I've gone through the steps probably between 15 and 20 times from 1 to 9. And the reason for that I believe, you know, I'm kind of like that mouse in the lever, you know, with the pleasure lever, and I keep hitting it and not eat. Well, I have this. I have a profound spiritual experience. My relationships get better. I feel I'm more connected to God. I'm more awake. I'm brighter. So it does well for me. I get good results. So I keep doing it. And when my spirit gets a little dull, I buff it up a little bit with a fourth and a fifth step and some amends, and it's amazing how wonderful and bright the world can be. So the first time we go through it, you know, it is a lot about the wreckage of our drinking, and it is about, like, it talks about the grosser items in stock and, you know, the big glaring shit. But it's the minutiae that trips up the alcoholic. It's not the boulder in the living room. It's the wrinkle in the carpet that makes us fall flat on our face. It was the clothes on the floor that tripped Chris and split his head. He didn't trip over the desk. You know, it's the little tiny things, it's the minutiae, it's the belief systems that we have, that we operate on, that are based in self, that often causes the difficulty. You know, and the big selfishnesses I get, like, I'm a big baby and I want everybody to like me, or, you know, I want to be loved, I want to be important. You know, that selfishness, or I want it, it's mine, you know, something that simple, that id selfishness. You know, I got it was the smaller versions of that escaped me for a really long time in terms of practical application of these principles. You know, and that's kind of what I want to talk about, those spiritual principles in terms of inventory, in terms of looking at oneself. You know, I was saying, I get a lot of women and you know, they do these inventories and they've written a 4-step, but none of them have written a fear or sex inventory. Apparently people only follow the picture in the book. 3-column, 4-step, no 4th column. And what do you mean? There's no fear inventory in this book. Really? There's some clear instructions here. What do you mean there's a sex ideal? What's a sex ideal? Well, I don't know. It's in this book. It says, you know, right here, oh my God. You know, it says, you know, whatever our ideal turns out to be. So Bill's assuming we have one. You know, so it's one of those things I think that, you know, happens in you know, in the fellowship, and, you know, that people, you know, they get most but not all. So I'll get a lot of people who, like I said, have written inventory. You know, it's very, very crude, blunt tool. They skipped the fear inventory. And I'll tell you what, you want to know why you do resentment, fear, and conduct? Is because the fear is the thing that motivates the resentment and causes the conduct. And so when I just look at the resentment, all I'm doing is looking at the belief systems I have in terms of your relationship or interaction with me. When I'm doing a fear inventory, I'm looking at the belief systems and the dynamic between myself and God. Because fear operates on the belief that I am God, or that God is not omnipotent. Because if God was omnipotent and all-powerful, there would be no need to be afraid. Now, we're there. So when we're looking at these inventories, when we're looking at these concepts and these things, you know, what we want to do is ask ourselves these questions and look at the 4th column in a very different way. But that begins with looking at the 3rd column in a different way. Do you guys know what the 3rd column of the resentment inventory is? It's amazing. It's found on page 66. Or actually 65 and 66. It says, on our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations that which had been interfered with? And then further down on the little picture, it says pride. So those are the 7 areas of self. Why does Bill have us look at and see whether or not a resentment or a reaction that we have to other people? And resentment means refelt emotion. It doesn't mean anger. Everybody always thinks resentment means anger. Resentment is anger, yes. It's shame. It's remorse. It's judgment. Who here can write an entire resentment inventory based on the judgments they have of other people? I have. So when we're looking at resentment, we're not just looking at, I'm pissed off at you, I wanted to hit you in the head with a brick. I want you to think about it in terms of more subtle things, like judgment. Like, think about it in terms of this, is when you have the reaction where you want to avoid somebody because you don't like how they make you feel, that's called a resentment. We don't call it that. We say they're annoying. We say, I avoid them because they're spiritually sick. Well, no shit, so are you. I'm an ass, you're an ass, so really? So when we're thinking about that, and that's what I said, I minimize, I rationalize. So I'm going to say, I wasn't resentful, I was frustrated. I'm not resentful, I'm annoyed. And I love it because for a long time I had to call in my nightly review to my sponsor. I was like, well, I wasn't really resentful, I was annoyed. He goes, oh, really, did you write the inventory on that? I was like, I didn't know we had an annoyance inventory. He's like, apparently you haven't been reading your big book. Resentment, refelt emotion. Shame. You ever like avoid somebody because when you see them, you know you did something that makes you feel shameful? Resentment. So when we're looking at this, we're not just looking at the big old things. I want you to really look at the minutia, because it's that minutia. It's those patterns of behavior. And I love when I talk to people, they say, okay, well, should I start writing my inventory when I started drinking? I said, no, start making your list when you started being an asshole. Seriously. I was an asshole long before I put booze in my body. My inventory starts there, you know? So one, that. Two, when we're looking at this, and again, we're looking at the minutia thing, I want you to look at detail. Here's the thing, is I love when I get people and they make a list and I say, okay, I want you to go into the quiet, get a pen and a piece of paper. I want you to ask God who needs to be on your inventory and just start making a list. Don't judge it. Don't go into the second column. Just make a list. What needs to be in your inventory, right? So they come out and they have this list of 80 people. And then when we sit down and we start doing the second column, they start going, well, I don't really resent them. That one doesn't really need to be on there. And, you know, that guy, like that person, that one, that doesn't belong in there. That's a petty one. All resentment's petty. I'm being petty when I'm being resentful. Yeah. You know? So the idea here is when we're looking at it, if you go to God, and a name comes up, a concept, an idea, a principle comes up on your first column, don't ever take it off. Because here's one thing. Is the name or the concept, the idea that you take off your inventory might be the very amend that you have to make. It might be the very truth that you need to see. I do not know what truth I need to see to keep me sober that might save my life, because I am not God. When I'm taking names or concepts or fears off my inventory because I don't want to write them because I think that they're boring and I don't want to kill a tree or my fingers might hurt or might take me longer, oh, any of those rationalizations or excuses that I make, am I not playing God? I went to God, I asked God for a list, I wrote down the list, and then I'm deciding what I'm editing God's work. Anyway, so let's take a 15-minute break and we'll come back.
My name's Bill. I'm an alcoholic. As you can tell, this workshop's being recorded, so if anybody wants to order the CD set of this weekend, please place your order before 5 o'clock this afternoon, and there's order forms over at the CD table. Thank you.